I'm Tommy McNeil. The United States Thursday recorded more than 1,100 deaths from COVID-19, marking the third straight day the nation passed that grim milestone as the pandemic escalates in southern and western U.S. states. Even though deaths are rising in the United States for a second week in a row, they do remain well below levels seen in April, when 2,000 people per day on average died from the virus. There are more than 631,000 deaths globally, and in the U.S., more than 144,000. Infections have skyrocketed to more than 15.4 million globally, and the U.S. hit a new milestone of more than 4 million infections. U.S. President Donald Trump has canceled segments of the Republican National Political Convention, scheduled to be held next month in Jacksonville, Florida, because of the increasing number of coronavirus cases. At a White House briefing Thursday evening, Mr. Trump said he did not think it was the right time to hold the convention with an outbreak of coronavirus in that state. He said that the delegate meetings in Charlotte, North Carolina would continue and the nomination would be put forth there. He said other events would be done with rallies and that he still plans to do a convention speech, although in a different form. The convention had moved to Jacksonville, Florida, after North Carolina's governor said a safe convention could not be held in Charlotte. Billionaire philanthropist and Microsoft founder Bill Gates is pushing back against some of the conspiracy theories spreading online, accusing him of creating the coronavirus outbreak. He said during a CNN town hall interview that it's a bad combination of pandemic and social media and people looking for a very simple explanation. What are said to be doctored photos and fabricated news articles have been crafted by conspiracy theorists and shared thousands of times on social media platforms and messaging apps in various languages. This is VOA News. Kurdish-Iranian exile and writer Behrouz Bochani, who was held in an Australian-run offshore island detention camp for about 6 years, has been granted refugee status in New Zealand. Bochani arrived in New Zealand about 8 months ago to speak at a literary festival and has stayed in Christchurch despite his visitor visa expiring. Bochani has been recognized as a refugee under the 1951 Convention Relating to the Status of Refugee and 1967 Protocol. Fiona Whiteridge from Immigration New Zealand told Reuters. Minnesota Governor Tim Walz says signed a police accountability law into Thursday that includes a ban on neck restraints like the one that was Floyd before his death in Minneapolis. The bill passed by the legislature earlier this week also bans chokeholds and so-called warrior-style training, which critics say promotes excessive force. It imposes a duty to intercede on officers who can see a colleague using excessive force. Officers will get more training in dealing with people with mental health issues and autism. Passage of that bill came after nearly 2 months of difficult negotiations that followed Floyd's death May 25th. And the ensuing unrest that spread around the world over police brutality as well as racism. The U.S. government admitted late Thursday that it made false statements in a lawsuit brought by New York State and told a court it would immediately lift a ban on New York residents participating in what it called its Trusted Traveler program. The disclosure came hours after the Department of Homeland Security had said that it would reinstate New Yorkers in a program which allows participants faster passage between the United States and either Canada or Mexico. In February, the DHS cut off New York from the program in response to the state's passage last June of a law allowing undocumented immigrants to apply for driver's licenses and limiting federal access to license information. And again, just recapping our top stories, there are now more than 631,000 deaths globally and from COVID-19. And in the United States, that figure is now more than 144,000. Infections have now skyrocketed to more than 15.4 million globally. And the U.S. hit the new milestone of more than 4 million infections on Thursday. And so recorded more than 1,100 deaths from COVID-19, marking the third straight day the nation passed the grim milestone as the pandemic escalates in southern and western U.S. states. More at voanews.com. Via remote, I'm Tommy McNeil, VOA News.
Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Friday, July 24th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. More and more Africa healthcare workers are testing positive for COVID-19.
One of the biggest challenges in protecting health workers has been the global shortage of personal protective equipment, which has severely affected countries on the continent.
Kenya's indigenous communities complain about forceful evictions from forests in the middle of COVID-19. Temporary basic income helped the world's poorest bridge COVID-19 crisis. And the MasterCard Foundation launches a Young Africa Works campaign in Uganda.
Access to finance is one of the key instruments that is needed to open the pathway for dignified and fulfilling livelihood and work opportunities.
Daniel Hailu is the regional head of the MasterCard Foundation in Eastern Southern Africa. And the threat to West Africa mangroves. Those stories plus Samson O'Malley Sports are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Thousands of healthcare workers across Africa have contracted coronavirus, a fact that worries international health officials who say the continent's health infrastructure is strained enough without the added threat. In South Africa, more than 3,500 healthcare workers have fallen ill and at least 34 have died. VOA's Anita Powell reports from Johannesburg.
Nearly 770,000 people have been known to have contracted COVID-19 in the African region. And, says Dr. Matsidisa Moeti, the World Health Organization's regional director for Africa, buried in those numbers is a key group that is on the front lines of the battle.
In the African region, more than 10,000 health workers have been infected with COVID-19. One of the biggest challenges in protecting health workers has been the global shortage of personal protective equipment, which has severely affected countries on the continent.
Moeti says more than 2 million items of PPE, including masks, goggles, and gloves, have been shipped to African countries so far, with many more in the pipeline. According to Ghana-based midwife Dr. Jemima Dennis-Antwi, the health workers getting sick aren't always the obvious ones. Of the more than 2,000 infected health workers in the West African country, a significant portion are nurses and midwives.
Over 410 nurses and midwives have been affected in Ghana on duty. And this is because, of course, we are designated to serve our patients 24/7. The increasing numbers of infectivity among health professionals, coupled with limited or lack of consistent supply of resources, as have been stated, result in refusal to attend to patients, psychological stress to self and families, constant threats of industrial actions among many in countries. These, as we all know, have serious implications for quality care, especially reproductive, maternal, newborn, child and adolescent care.
Experts are calling for more protective equipment, for greater testing for health professionals, and for some common sense solutions. For example, Dennis-Antwi suggested that healthcare facilities should provide meals for on-shift workers to keep them from leaving the grounds to seek food. In Sierra Leone, officials are thinking even bigger, says Health Minister Dr. Alpha Wuri. In coming weeks, the nation plans to roll out a health insurance plan for all health workers. Most of the continent's affected health workers are in South Africa, the continent's viral hotspot. But Moeti said epidemiologists are seeing COVID-19 spreading to health workers in Algeria, Kenya, Ghana, and Ivory Coast. She says governments are reacting to the influx of data to avoid harsh measures such as complete lockdowns.
We've seen some countries, Cote d'Ivoire is an example, really use the data to adjust the response, if you like, lockdown locally where it's necessary to enable life to continue and the economy to open up in other localities. I think that one of the most important things to do is to really enable people to grapple with the challenging circumstances and play their role in limiting the spread.
That, she said, is the best strategy. Wear a mask, wash your hands thoroughly and often, and keep your distance. Anita Powell, VOA News, Johannesburg.
The Ogek and Sengwe ethnic groups in Kenya say authorities have forcefully evicted them from the Mau and Mbobo forests, burning hundreds of homes and leaving families homeless in the middle of the COVID-19 pandemic. The Kenyan government began the evictions last year, saying communities living in the forest were damaging the environment. Rights groups say the ethnic groups were protecting the forest from illegal logging and poaching. Mohammed Yusuf reports.
In a media briefing held over Zoom Thursday, Kenya's indigenous communities complain of harassment and constant evictions from forests they have called home for centuries. Milka Chepkorir represents the Sengwer community. She says the COVID-19 pandemic has not stopped Kenyan authorities from evicting her people.
This is one of the evictions that have really hit us differently, because it's evictions during COVID times. It's evictions when children are not in school and they are playing in the glades, and from nowhere they're just being rendered homeless. And it is during the very coldest season of the year up in the mountains.
Last week, Ogie community families were evicted from their forest homes. Daniel Kobei says he and 50,000 Ogie people have known evictions all their lives.
We want to be very clear that the Ogiek have become subjects of eviction. And the recent one, which has removed over 300 families, they are now homeless, and they are always being housed by their neighbors. And one of the issues is that the Ogiek community, with their people refusing to honor their ancestral ownership of Mao, have led them every time being said they have become a subject of eviction.
According to Human Rights Watch, 50,000 families in all have been evicted from the Mao forest, and 6,000 families have been removed in recent months. The rights group also notes that in some instances, security officers used force to push people out of the forest. It says several people were injured in beatings and homes were burned down. Kenyan government spokesman Cyrus Oguna dismissed the Human Rights Watch allegations, saying via text message that their concerns are emotional, driven by certain acts of activism and not research. He also said the government will protect Kenyan forests for the good of the country, but in a human manner. Peter Kitelo, the chairman of Community Land Action Now, a network representing pastoral and forest communities, said evictions have been going on for decades in the name of conservation.
Most of the lands that we were evicted from, the ones that had, you know, the best forests, because at the moment, for the Ogie community of Mount Elgon, the community has been pushed up on the moorlands, and the real forest is on the lower side. What has happened with those forests over the years has been logging. And today, there is almost no forest. The only natural forest is still found on where the community is at the moment.
The government wants Kenya to have 10% forest cover by 2022, up from 7% now. Chepkorir of the Sengwer community says the best way forward is for the government to recognize the rights of the Ogiek and Sengwer communities to live in the forest and work with them to achieve conservation. Mohammed Yusuf for VOA News, Nairobi.
A United Nations program is calling for a guaranteed temporary basic income for nearly 3 billion of the world's poorest people to shield them from the worst impact of COVID-19. The proposal argued that the financial aid would help slow the spread of the pandemic by enabling impoverished beneficiaries to stay home. Lisa Schlein reports from Geneva.
The United Nations Development Program says that 1 billion people live below the poverty line on $1.90 a day. Nearly 2 billion others live just above the poverty line, but are at risk of falling below. About 70% work in the informal sector. They are self-employed, unpaid, and not protected by any social insurance scheme. Despite COVID-19 lockdown measures, people who work in the informal sector are forced to leave their homes to eke out enough money to support themselves and their families. UN Development Fund chief economist and lead author of the report, George Gray Molina, tells VOA their prospects of weathering the current crisis without a guaranteed income are bleak.
What we'll see is quite horrific. It's, people with no jobs, no livelihoods, no income, with containment policies that are variable. Some are working, some are not working. If they don't work, then you see the spread of the virus. It gets worse and worse. So it's a vicious cycle. And this can be part, we think, of breaking that vicious cycle.
The UNDP estimates $1.2 trillion would be needed to provide a temporary basic income for nearly 3 billion of the poorest people in 132 developing countries for 6 months. Molina notes this sum is nearly equivalent to the $1.3 trillion of what developing countries owe in external debt payments this year. He says one way that countries could pay for the temporary basic income, or TBI, would be to defer payment of their external debt for a year.
The Secretary General of the UN has called for a comprehensive debt standstill, which would include, you know, all private creditors and also official bilateral creditors. So that's one source that we think could work. It's a standstill for 1 year, so you'd stop paying the banks for a year, but then you would restart paying the banks as soon as the TBI is over.
Several countries already have taken steps to introduce a temporary basic income. For example, UNDP reports Togo has distributed more than $19.5 million in monthly financial aid to nearly 13% of the population through its cash transfer program. Women who work in the informal sector are the main beneficiaries. It says Brazil and Colombia recently began registering people as a prelude to receiving financial aid. It adds that Spain recently approved a monthly budget of $289 million to supplement the incomes of 850,000 vulnerable families and 2.3 million individuals. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
You are listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voices of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Friday, July 24th. The MasterCard Foundation has launched a Young Africa Works campaign in Uganda. The program seeks to help the youth access fulfilling jobs by 2030. The initiative plans to use technology to help connect both employers and job seekers in the East African country. The initiative is also currently underway in Rwanda, Ethiopia, and Kenya. Daniel Hailu, the regional head of the MasterCard Foundation in East and Southern Africa, says the strategy will enable entrepreneurs and small businesses to grow and enable vocational training so that young people can acquire needed skills for the job market. He tells viewers Peter Clotty that the organization's objective is also part of the Ugandan government's focus on improving agriculture, construction and housing, and tourism and hospitality.
Today was a big day. So we had the launch of Young Africa Works in Uganda. But very important, I'd like to point out that, in fact, we have been working in Uganda since 2008. So we are no strangers to that country. Today was a culmination of a lot of activities that have taken place to position our partners in Uganda to be able to do the work of enabling young people to access dignified and fulfilling work. So today was a milestone, but the actual work has been going on. And actually, we started the implementation of this strategy called Young Africa Works in Uganda late last year. So this event today really was an opportunity for us to create a platform to make visible the work that's already been taking place in Uganda and really build us a bridge to the future going forward.
One of the strategies is to enable young men and women to access financial support in case they want to have businesses and all that. Talk to me about the resource and how significant this will be for the youth in Uganda.
Absolutely. So access to finance, as it's called, is one of the key levers. It's one of the key instruments that is needed to open the pathway for dignified and fulfilling livelihood and work opportunity. We oftentimes come across situations where young people looking to start their business, start an enterprise, are faced with a situation that is not conducive to their accessing finance from commercial institutions, banks. So the role we play is we come in and we work sometimes with commercial institutions, banks, to basically make young people, young entrepreneurs, a viable customer for a loan. So we de-risk the loan for the bank, essentially, to make this instrument available for young people. And look, funding is a key element of a business growth strategy. It's not the only thing, but it is one of the essential ingredients. And our strategy has this included And specifically in Uganda, we're working with Equity Bank as a partner that will provide these kinds of solutions for young people.
How is your organization, the MasterCard Foundation, working closely with the Ugandan government so there wouldn't be a conflict and you will move in step to address the high unemployment youth rate in Uganda?
So our strategy at the core involves a consultation with the governments of the countries that we're working in, and Uganda is no exception. So our strategy in Uganda is aligned with the government's priority sectors, and it embraces private sector-led economic development approaches as well. But that work of alignment really started 2 years ago through a series of conversations where we listened to the strategy, we listened to the needs, and we ensured that our approach ultimately does align with a national level approach, because we are looking to do things that are, that will be able to scale significantly. And our experience is, again, working on the continent in countries where, again, government plays a significant role in driving policy change, in enabling business environments that are conducive to growth. That connection with government is essential. And Uganda is a good example where today we actually had a session that allowed us to illustrate that that work has taken place and it will continue to take place.
Daniel Hailu is the regional head of the MasterCard Foundation in East and Southern Africa. You're speaking with VOA's Peter Clotty. This Sunday, July 26th, is World Mangrove Day, and researchers from the Mangrove Action Project are calling attention to the important role of mangroves in biodiversity conservation. The coast of West Africa is home to many important mangrove locations. Dominic Woodgrave, executive director of the group, spoke to Ricky Stryak about current threats to these West Africa mangroves.
Mangroves are beautiful in their own way, but they are a very hard ecosystem to work in. And if you're sort of moving around and the mud is sort of hip deep, it's hard work, and you know, pardon mosquitoes and so on. But they're incredibly valuable because they provide an awful lot of services and goods and services to local people. They offer sort of storm protection, lots of materials in order to build houses, fuel wood to cook on, palms that can produce roofing sections, and also lots of other things. Erosion sort of reduction, I don't think they necessarily stop erosion. They can reduce saltwater intrusion, protect particularly West Coast Africa from storm surges if they're relatively intact and healthy. A lot of carbon storage, which you would have come across before, which a lot of people refer to as blue carbon. And then their productivity is also very significant in terms of acting as a nursery for fish or crab or shrimp, but also organic material that is produced in the mangrove that is then exported into the near shore. And that really increases the productivity of what the artisanal fishermen can catch. Even though they might not be as glamorous, say, as coral, they're still incredibly valuable as ecosystems.
When we talk about the coast of West Africa, as you mentioned, what are some of the threats?
I think that the threats actually are pretty common around the world. It's not necessarily just specific to West Coast Africa. I think a lot of coastal communities have essentially the same sort of problem. Some issues related to climate change. As climate changes, my understanding is that the frequency of big storms and sort of violent weather is not increasing, but the intensity of that weather is increasing. And so therefore the storms are battering the mangroves. The storms can then move a lot of the sediment around the soil around their feet really quite sort of quickly, so it can erode mangroves away or dump a lot of sand on top of them, which is both of which are a problem. But also the sea level rise means that the mangroves have got to migrate sort of upland and inland, and often there isn't any space to do that. Mangroves are the distribution of mangroves is largely controlled by inundation and flooding. How often are they underwater?
What are the tools you guys think need to be employed? And especially I'm wondering if indigenous methods and knowledge of these areas are, you know, more and more being employed to conserve the mangrove.
In terms of conservation and restoration, the challenge as MAP sees it is that it's not so much needing to be innovative. We don't get the basics right. We teach a process called community-based ecological mangrove restoration, which uses the science to facilitate natural regeneration where at all possible. The challenge we see is that a lot of restoration efforts fail because they are trying to restore inappropriate areas.
That was Dominic Waldegrave, Executive Director of the Mangrove Action Project. He was speaking to Ricky Stryak from the Philippines. It's time now for Daybreak Africa Sports, and here is Samson O'Malley in Abuja, Nigeria. A very good Friday morning to you, Samson.
Good Friday morning to you too, James. We begin the sports in the Democratic Republic of Congo, where renowned lawyer and writer Bestin Kazadi made history by becoming the first woman ever to be elected as president of the DRC football giant AS Vita Club. Kazadi, who was elected earlier this month, has been speaking to my colleague James Butty on her vision for the club.
My vision is essentially based on sport business. I want to make V Club a financially independent club that is to say to generate our own funds, generate income for the club to allow athletes to have good working conditions to sign win-win contracts and to make good recruitments. Have a proactive and ambitious technical staff who have a winning project and a sport project. I think that it's very important to have those human, financial and material resources to make V Club a successful club.
The first African coach to win a European League title, Nigeria's Emmanuel Ndubuisi Egbo, believes his personal success will add value to football management on the African continent. Coach Egbo, who won the Albanian Top Flight League title, the first African coach to win a European League title, Nigeria's Emmanuel Ndubuisi Egbo, believes his personal success will add value to football management on the African continent. Coach Egbo, who won the Albanian Top Flight League title with KF Tirana with two games left and qualified the team for the UEFA Champions League, made history by becoming the first African manager from the continent to achieve such feat.
I believe it's not only just a celebration for me, it's a celebration for all Africans, all Nigerians, and all black race everywhere they are for this wonderful, amazing feat that we succeeded in doing all the way far away from my own country. It's still sinking down because I was just thinking I was doing my job just to train my team to try to win the league after 11 years away, not winning the league.
Staying with football news, the South African Football Association has released a statement giving their full support towards the Black Lives Matter movement. SAFA's statement comes hours after South African football legend Mark Fish shocked the world by openly criticizing the hashtag BLM movement on Twitter. And that's it on Daybreak Africa Sports. I am Samson O'Malley in Abuja, Nigeria. It's back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Samson. Have a very good weekend. And that's it for this Friday, July 24th edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for spending this week with us. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa team, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, as well as sports editor Samson O'Malley, along with all of our engineers, I'm James Barton in Washington, wishing you a very good weekend.
VOA brings you the best in African music on the African beat. African Beat showcases the latest and the greatest of contemporary African music, from bubu music to hip life, bongo flavor to soukous, Afrobeat to ndumbulu and makossa to kwaito. The African beat on VOA has it all. And it's happening right here, Mondays through Fridays at 09:05 and 20:05 UTC, right after the international news.
Hello, Africa. This is Peter Clotty, host of VOA's Africa Weekend show, Nightline Africa. Tune in. You will be glad you did.
Nightline Africa is a fast-paced, tightly edited news show designed to keep our listeners engaged from beginning to end. Nightline comes to you live from the Voice of America on the following shortwave frequencies: 6080 kilohertz, 49.3 meter band, and 15580 kilohertz, 19.2 meter band.